Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Sempre Milan podcast. I'm your host, Ollie Fisher, joined once again by Maddie, who's in the second slot today with AJ's absence.
Got bumped up a slot. Feeling important. We have CEO of the B team.
Yes.
Nice to be back, guys. One day I'll be in that middle slot, or maybe even the far left. Who knows?
Head honcho. Yeah, maybe. You never know. Like, the rotation strategy is going pretty well at the moment. We're doing it better than Pioli does, because last week, by virtue of the fact that I was in Chicago and Maddie couldn't make it either, we had AJ and Stefano doing a twosome for the first time. And now we've got three new guys. So that's five people across 2 weeks. So if you ever get bored of one of us, just know that they'll probably not be here next week. If you can hear me sounding not as crisp and as energetic as usual, I'm loaded up on medication and stuff at the moment. I caught the Yank bug while I was in Chicago for like the second half of the week. I was completely wiped out, really struggling. It might have been COVID, but I was not going to take a test to prove it. So I just say I had the flu, and I'm shrugging it off at the moment. So yeah, apologies if I sound a little bit ropey. Perhaps it's, you know, to my blessing that we don't have four games or anything to talk about this week. We're just in the second week of the international break, so we'll go through what some of our players have been doing. Then, of course, we have the Juventus game to preview, which is another big game inside our first 10. We know what our daunting schedule has been like, and a couple of talking points and some questions to go through. So it'll still be a wall-to-wall action-packed episode for you guys. We start with the internationals. I'm just going to put it under talking points to begin this episode. Some of the internationals that have been going on. Now, international football divides us all. Some people think there's too much of it, especially too much of it that is meaningless. And I tend to be more on that side. But there were some interesting things that have happened to our players during this break. The first one that I thought was interesting, although he hasn't played, is that Krunic got called up by Bosnia. He's been injured for like the last 3 or 4 weeks, as we know. He's missed important games for us.
Did he play?
He did not play, no. We're recording this on the Monday afternoon, most of the countries have only played one of their two games. So we'll see if he features, for example, in the second game. He didn't play in the first game, but the coach was asked about why he's called Krunic up, because he's not played for Milan for the last few games. We've obviously played Adli and Reinders in that defensive midfield spot. And he said, because the information we have is that he might be able to play, which is a fair enough answer, I suppose. But I will be a bit pissed off if he does take part in the second game, because we were led to believe, you know, he might not even make it back for the Juve game, although reports on that front are a bit more optimistic now. Moving on. Then we start with a goal for Christian Pulisic. Everything he touches turns to gold. Maddie, did you watch this one?
No, I didn't.
You love an international friend.
We were over at my sister's house celebrating Jude's first birthday, and I could not find their remote, so we didn't turn on the TV. Mm. But I was excited when I saw it was 1-0, and then I looked back and it was 3-1. Pulisic scored a wonder goal. I did see it afterwards, but, you know, we still lost, and Greg Berhalter sucks, so.
Yeah, seen a few Berhalter out shouts after that, and I'm thinking, surely a game against Germany in a friendly isn't what you're measuring yourself with.
Or he plays people really think? He just plays very unattractive football. Mm. And he plays for, like, 1-0 wins, right? And you can't do that. Mm. He's also only won against two European teams, being Bosnia and, like, not Yugoslavia. They don't even exist anymore. I forgot the other one.
Yeah, so maybe he's... I've always said that about the USA. It's like, it is easy to get hype when you're putting all these teams to the sword in the confederation that you guys play in. But then, you know, when play some actual tougher tests, friendlies, major tournaments, that kind of thing, it's always a bigger indication.
We play well against South American teams. Like, we tend to play well against them. I don't know what it is about European opponents. I think it's just our manager doesn't, like, he is not a good manager. The players love him, though, so I don't know.
Berhalter out, then. Or move him to like a player liaison officer role or something like that. But delighted for Pulisic anyway, because he played on the left, I believe, or at least his goal came from the left. We cut inside onto his right foot and curled it. Not quite into the top corner, but, you know, three quarters of the way up the net. It was an absolutely gorgeous goal. Great to see. And for him to even take that shot on, let alone score it, execute it perfectly, shows the level of confidence that he's playing with right now. And we need that to continue. I'd be more worried if he passed up that shot and you know, gave it to a teammate or whatever. But as we know, since his summer move to Milan, he's become a consistent starter. He has four goals, the most recent one being a massive one inside the last 5 minutes against Genoa to earn all 3 points. The other goals have been important too. Pulisic, new lease of life. Lorenzo, early candidate for signing of the season?
Yeah, definitely. I think he's been wicked. That goal, I just want to say, I only saw it the other day. What a fit. Not only was the finish fantastic, I mean, we're talking against Ter Stegen. I know it's a friendly, but he is one of the best keepers in the world. We can't forget that. But the run into space, I mean, he attacked that space so well. Burst of speed, it was fantastic. Yeah, he's been on fire. I was saying to a friend the other day that if we can get even sort of 50 to 60% of his Dortmund form back to what he is at Milan, then we're on to an absolute winner. But it seems like obviously he's matured anyway, so he's going to be a much more rounded player. But yeah, he's been absolutely brilliant. What is it, 4 goal contributions in 8 games or so in total, isn't it?
So definitely got 4 goals.
I think a couple, maybe 2. Maybe he's on 6 there. I mean, he's been wicked, yeah.
I think I'm going to...
4 goals, 1 assist.
4 goals, yeah. 1 assist. Okay, 5-8. 5-8, which is still brilliant.
We've heard that fantastic. A lot. Yeah. Like, it's a fantastic rate. It's like... It's
you would have told us that at the beginning of the season, half of the team or half of the... 75% of the fans would be like, no. And then the other 25% are just delusional Pulisic fans who would have said, absolutely.
AJ. He's been really good. He's been a delight to watch, in fairness.
That's been used a lot as well as that line of sort of getting him back to his Dortmund form. And if you look at the numbers that he put up at Dortmund, he was never actually really prolific when you consider that he's currently on pace to score, you know, 16, 17 goals this season in the league. Now, we don't expect him to keep up this pace. I think it would be unreasonable to expect him to score, you know, 4-8 for the remainder of the season. However, what it does show is we've got a real candidate here to be one of the players to score double figures. And you've got to be looking for 4 or 5 guys to chip in with double figures goals, especially when we don't have the hitman centre forward that, say, an Inter and Napoli have. That is the point, though, with getting him back to his Dortmund form. It's not necessarily about his output. It's about his confidence levels and how comfortable he feels in the system, how valued by the coach. And so far, so good. Like, going into the season, I think we mentioned it on here, it seemed that Liao and Pulisic's wingers could be really complementary because of the way one of them's so direct and he's always looking for that match-winning play. And then Pulisic, on the other hand, he's the one who's going to pick his head up and wait and look to make the right decision. And in actual fact, it's been Pulisic has been the more prolific one and the one who's been scoring goals leading to points. And long may it continue. So it was good to see that. Speaking of Liao, he seems to have that Portugal starting spot now, or at least he started again for them in a 3-2 win over Slovakia. I'm just looking here to see how many minutes he got. He got 65 before he was replaced by João Félix, but he started over João Félix. So
twice, yeah.
So there you go. I think we're starting to see the signs there. They won 3-2 in the end, but, you know, he didn't manage a goal or an assist, which is a bit of a shame. Then we've got on the list Tomori. Ah, yes. Finally, Fit gets a start with 3 lions on his chest. We've been crying out for this for some time, especially me
Was it a meaningful game?
For my sins. It was a friendly against Australia. So no is the answer to that. However, England have got problems at centre-back at the moment. They've got injuries. So I don't think he would start if everybody is fit. He started alongside Levi Colwill, though. And for those who don't follow the Premier League, there's a really interesting story in that both are Cobham graduates, both came through the academy at Chelsea. Both of them had loan spells in the Championship as well. Tomori spent time at Hull City and Derby. Colwill spent time at Huddersfield Town, where he made a name for himself. So I was personally buzzing to see them two start together at centre-back. It was like everything, all my biggest dreams come true at once. And they kept a clean sheet and he looked pretty solid, albeit Australia are shite. They didn't really have much going up front.
Yeah, I think that game was, it was whatever. The game tomorrow is the big one for both Italy and England. And that, if he starts, which he should, I mean, he's playing against Italy, he knows the opposition well, then that will be a sign that he's given Southgate's given him trust. But let's be honest, I don't think he'll start tomorrow in any way. It's a must-win game for both teams because it means automatic qualification, if I'm right in saying that, the winning team.
If either team wins. I mean, for England, they can probably afford one more slip-up, but for Italy, if they were to win, then yeah, it would mean Ukraine pretty much can't catch either of us. I mean, our last three games, we've got two against North Macedonia and one against Malta, so should be fine. But yeah, Italy really need a result because otherwise it opens the door again. And I think they might get one, to be honest, because we can never beat Italy in anything apart from away earlier in the thing when Retegi scored.
They've been all right. Just no Milan players, but they've actually... Well, Bonaventura, I'm counting him as a Milan player. I know he's not, but just for Italy's purposes. Yeah.
No, I'm actually going. I got a ticket for it, so I'm hoping I'm a bit better for it. Nice. And I'm going to go Wembley and see. And I haven't seen, like, normally a couple of the reporters for the major newspapers will come out with a predicted team, but it's usually the evening before the game and we're not quite there yet. So I have no idea if Tomori is expected to start this. However, if Southgate stays true to what he's been saying recently about picking players based on form, and we know he's gone against that in the past, but he picked Tomori for the last game, so then Tomori should get the nod over Maguire, for example, or we might go with Colwill alongside Stones, who is a more natural left-sided player. We'll have to wait and see on that one, but it does make sense to play Tomori against players that he has faced multiple times in the past domestically, so we'll wait and see if Southgate needs
which means it won't happen.
Yeah, it means he won't start.
It won't happen.
But let's hope for an interesting game regardless on that front. Netherlands v France towards the back end of last month. There were four players for Milan fans to be watching over. Tijani Reinders got his first full competitive start for the Netherlands, which was fantastic to see. That shows how much he has gone up in the estimations of Ronald Koeman, because Holland have plenty of attacking and midfield talent, you know. So for him to force his way in there and to play from the start against France in, you know, it's one of the biggest tests that you can get in European football. So that was good to see. And then on the French side, you had Maignan, Théo, and even Giroud came on for a bit. France ended up winning that game, and they have now qualified for Euro 2024, having won 6 out of 6. So they're plain sailing. Happy days. And the last thing that I've got down here is Kier. He got his 129th cap for Denmark, which equals Peter Schmeichel, who holds the record for the most international caps for Denmark. So he's going to move into outright number one very shortly. And good to see him getting minutes under his belt, because you don't know when we might need him. You know, it's good to keep him in match rhythm, albeit they've got a pretty crap group, to be honest. So yeah, that's where we're at with international business, and we'll wait and see what happens over the next 36 hours-ish with the remaining games to come. Let's hope no injuries, because we have got some big games to come. Speaking of which, we move on to the Juventus preview. First game back after the break is on Sunday night at San Siro. It's already been determined a sellout, which is good. You know, it means we'll have been above 70,000 attendance for every single game this season. Our record against Juventus in recent years has massively upturned. I mean, I remember when, from like the early 2010s through until around about 3 or 4 years ago, when if we were playing Juventus at home, it was just whether they were going to win 1-0 or 2-0. Like, that was it. They came and they routinely beat us, and we could never get anything going from an attacking point of view, it seemed. But then things turned with that 4-2 comeback win in the COVID era when it was in front of no fans. We went 2-0 down in that, scored four goals to come back and win. And from there on, it feels like we've kind of had their number, to be honest.
Is that when Rebic got a brace?
He definitely, it was.
It was the first goal. Box goal with him, definitely.
There was Zlatan penalty to make it 2-1. Then I think it was Kessié who scored the... Oh, I can't even remember. Maybe Rebic did get a brace. He definitely got one in that game. It was the last one because that's when he did the salute celebration as if to say game.
It was outside the box, wasn't it?
That was in the 3-0 win away from home when he curled one top bins also during COVID. Yeah, Tomori scored in that one. Tomori's another player who scored multiple goals against Juve, so let's have another one.
Ibra, Kessié, Liao, Rebic.
That's it, yeah. So the Liao goal was really weird. He rolled it in at the near post through a few bodies. But that seemed to be the game that turned things around for us. And I no longer really fear playing Juve. Now, whether that's more a symptom of the fact that they had their title streak snapped and they haven't been able to get back into it yet. And then when they seemed like they had a bit of momentum, there was the whole capital gains and the salary scandal and stuff. And it's kind of killed any momentum that they were trying to generate. A few people had them down. I don't know how you two feel about this. A few people had them down as serious title challenges for this season because of the absence of European competition. And that meaning that they generally are going to play one game a week. They have started the season. They're in and around. Like, they're not a million miles off. And in actual fact, they did leapfrog us at one point. But results like conceding 4 against Sassuolo and stuff, I just don't think they're quite there for me yet.
No. I feel like they're very hot and cold.
Mm.
You know, they just have not really, like, they're not as, I guess, intimidating to play against as they once were. They're trying to figure out how to spend money correctly and not cheat. Something that they haven't had to do because, like, they've been winning the league. So they've been top dog. They've been getting Champions League, right? They didn't get Champions League last year, so they got no European revenue. And it's kind of showing in the mindset of the players that they have and the skill of the players. So.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably in the minority here because I actually have them down as winning Scudetto with us. It's a toss-up still. The reason I say that is because I'm probably opposite to you, Ollie, whereas you think, obviously, Inter are, by and large, the strongest team in the league. I categorically don't think that they are at all. I think they're incredible. They are so good at what they do, but they are the definition of a one-dimensional team. I think when any team can play against their system, they often play better than them. You've seen it in the Champions League recently. And I think their numbers are stat padded against a lot of the weaker sides. With that being said, Juve, on the other hand, although a completely
stat padded against weaker sides, I guess.
Yeah. Rather
that than drop points, as we have been doing.
But like you said, Maddie, I completely agree with you. Juve are hot and cold, but I just cannot get past how much of an advantage it is to have only league football. It is such an advantage, especially when you get into the congested period that we're in, the congested period in sort of the springtime. It's a huge advantage that all Juve need to do is just beat the other team. They don't even need to beat the top teams, as in, I say the top teams being probably Inter, Milan. They don't need to. They just need to beat the other teams, but they're hot and cold. So, yeah, I just think the opposite to you, Ollie. I think that Inter are very beatable. I do. I know that they thrashed us, but they're the only team. We're the only team that have, lost. We're the only team that have had them as a loss. I don't know.
Yeah. Sassuolo have beaten both Inter and Juve this season, so they're keeping their reputation going as well as being the difficult ones to play against. Yeah, and obviously Inter, because we weren't on last week, we obviously leapfrogged Inter, who coughed up a 2-goal lead at home against Bologna. So yeah, there are some cracks appearing with them, and I like to see that because it was going a bit too plain sailing for them. up until that point. So I am glad to see that they're having a little bit of an introspective moment, really. And I feel like now would have been a better time to play them if we could. Obviously, you can't pick and choose your moments, but by contrast, we've conceded one goal since that 5-1 defeat against Inter, and that was in a 3-1 win against Cagliari. Whereas Inter are showing just a few more defensive leaky signs and whatnot. And but yeah, obviously this is Juve we're playing, who beat us 9 times in a row between January 2017 and November 2019. They beat us 9 times in a row. And we scored four goals in those 9 games. They kept a clean sheet 5 times in those 9. I remember us taking the lead a couple of times and not being able to hang on. But they have beaten us once since then in the 9 games that have followed. We've won 4 of the 9. So for Juve to go 1 win in 9 against us, and if you remember, that win that they did get was the 3-1 at San Siro when Calabria played in midfield because we didn't have any players, you know, and we equalised in that game. So it shows that things have flipped a little bit in that sense, and we like to see that. Obviously, we did the double over them last season, which was massive, the 2-0 home victory and then the Giroud winner away from home. First time that we've done the double over them since 2009-10, when we beat them 3-0 home and away. So, yeah, as I say, the tide has kind of turned in this rivalry, and it is still a rivalry. I mean, do you two hate Inter more than Juve or vice versa?
Personally, I hate Inter more. I have, what's the word? I have more respect for Inter in a way because I think Juve are a massive cheating club, but I don't like Inter's, the way they carry themselves. They carry themselves as if they're a bigger, more important club in Milan than Milan are. And I just think that categorically isn't true. You just see it through everything they do, from their transfer business historically. You know, they've always tried to sign players off the back that we've tried to sign. That they are just almost, in a lot of respects, that they are. You know, we did it for years. but Juve obviously cheat. And I also prefer Juve's players historically, also from an Italy point of view. They've had some really important players. But yeah, that's mine.
I think I hate Inter more, but like you guys come across probably more Inter and Juve fans than I do. Like there's not a lot of Serie A fans around here. So like I don't interact with many of them to like get underneath my skin, where like Liverpool, United, like there's a lot of those and they get under my skin, you know? So like that's where my hatred comes from. What?
So I was just going to say, I reckon it's, I don't come across any, because I would imagine there's more Italians in obtusely in America than there are in this country. I don't know.
Potentially. Yeah.
Right. I mean, in Metro Detroit, right? Like, I'm not on the East Coast.
Yeah. So, fair enough. Or like Chicago. Do you know what? Chicago surprised me how big the Italian community is there. It is huge. Yeah. A lot of Italian restaurants. And I really wanted to go to Milan Club Chicago. So if anyone from there is listening, I do apologize that I wasn't able to make it along to that. I would have done. But it was the day after we arrived. And I honestly didn't think I was going to make the game because it was an earlier kickoff and jet lag and shit. But did manage to catch the Genoa game just in the hotel room while nodding off a little bit. But yeah, I was surprised by the number of Italian restaurants, bars, etc., and obvious communities in Chicago. So I think that, yeah, there probably is a larger portion that migrated over to the States. But there's still stuff like Inter Club London, even like a Roma Club London. So you still get rats. There's plenty of rats in London. That's all I'll say. But personally speaking, it used to be Juve without a doubt. It used to be Juventus when they were winning the league year after year, because it felt like Milan and Inter, not just because of the cohabitants of the same city, it just felt like we had kind of a shared struggle. It was like, right, how do we overthrow these bastards? You know, the winning league title after league title with dominant teams, and they're going far in Europe without ever capturing the elusive crown. But how do we stop this from happening? And then when it was them that won it first, the collective thing kind of went out of it, and it became a stick to beat us with. Like, oh, we got 19, you've got 18. And I think that's when the rivalry soured, was when it became a battle between us two for the title. And then obviously we've had stuff like the Scudetto season we won, and we rubbed it right in Inter's face because they fumbled the bag in that Bologna game. Then stuff like the Champions League semi-final and the recent derbies have been so one-sided that that's added a bit of toxicity to it. And now I think the game means more in general. And then you've got the added derby flavour to it that I just think at the moment, yeah, I despise Inter. But I don't like what Juve stand for as the establishment club, as the cheating, corrupt, historically, like that's not an allegation. It has been proven. I'm not a big fan of them. And I also don't like the casual element to them because like they've got such a big following in the south of Italy. And it's kind of like the Man United fans you get all over Essex and stuff. It's like, oh, you're just latching on to a... Whereas right. I think that Northern Italy is still the hotbed for both Milan clubs.
That's actually a really good point. I think the sort of changing is probably actually a more accurate critical reflection on that rivalry. But I just don't know how Inter carry themselves. That's the issue I have.
Yeah, that as well. Yeah.
At least Juve deserve to be big, you know, in a sense. Corruption or not, they are huge.
Yeah, well, they got that way because of corruption.
Well,
you know,
that's fair. That is fair.
But like, you know, when Juve made the Champions League final, what, like 4 or 5 years ago, their fans were fucking annoying. Like thinking that they deserve to be there. Like, no, like you've won like what, 2 Champions Leagues with in the past like 40 years, you know, and they're like the domestic Manchester United.
They kind of are. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think there's more, there's interesting parallels between us, and I don't really like them, but there's parallels between like us and Liverpool, because we've had more of the success in Europe. And obviously, domestically, they've had a little bit of a resurgence where Man United have struggled, but then Manchester United have definitely been more the domestic team. And now it's Man City just winning everything. So there's your Farmers League. Back to this particular game. Anyway, the big news for us is obviously we don't have Mike Maignan, who attempted to decapitate someone in the Genoa game. Sure. So he's got a one-game ban that he's serving for this. And Teo Hernandez is also serving a one-game ban for this game by virtue of picking up his 5th yellow card in the 8th game of the season, as you do. It's like Bennacer in his first season when he did the same. Replacing them, obviously we know Spartiello is going to be coming in for Maignan, and so far he's looked like an okay backup. What are we doing at left back? Are we switching Florenzi over? Is this the game at San Siro, home crowd, where you say to Bartizaghi, let's see how you get on? You've got an informed Tomori next to you, so you can have a little bit of cover there. Or are you going for the more experienced option?
It's a great question.
Yeah.
I put the young guy in. Bertizaghi, I didn't want to try to say his name, but I just
17 years old, signed his first professional contract earlier in the month. I might have been late last month. He's had a really memorable summer. Obviously, he got taken on the preseason tour of the USA. As I say, 17 years old, to be considered in and around the first team is a testament to his development and how strong they think he is. More importantly, I think they look at him and think he's physically ready because he's a big unit and he slotted in at centre-back a couple of times during pre-season. He's made his Serie A debut. He's actually played twice off the bench, so there is that to consider. He's had a little taster. But I just think that Pioli's Pioli. You know, he's going for Florenzi.
100%. Florenzi to the left. 100%. Bartosaghi will come on at about the 75th, 65th minute. That's guaranteed. You know,
Might there be some temptation to play a back three? Just so, because like with the Verona game, out of nowhere, for example, we saw the willingness to go to a back three and play with wing backs. Given, admittedly, in that game he didn't have Calabria or Teo, so he didn't have the two natural fullbacks in his team. But he then went to wing-backs playing Musa on the right side and Florenzi on the left side just to give them a bit of added defensive protection. I was just thinking if we might see a little return to that.
Kalulu's fit.
Kalulu's expected to be back,
That could work then because Florenzi's delivery for crosses is probably the best in the squad. And I think we can probably take a big advantage of that because his delivery is great. So, I can see him on as left wing-back. Calabria, right wing back, Kalulu, Tomori, Chow. Yeah, I mean,
we're in a 3-5-2 now.
3-4-3, 3-5, yeah, something like that. I think the thing you need to keep unchanged is the front three. You know, it needs to be Liao, Giroud, Pulisic for now, because those are your three most. Well, I don't want to say Giroud's in form, but you know, he does still have the most goals to his name.
It's a little padded stat, kind of like a Juve trophy count.
Penalties. Yeah. So I think you need to keep that front three together, and then Verona, I think maybe the opponent was something that factored into it, but seeing the willingness to play just the two in midfield and say that'll be enough protection for the back three, it proved to be the case. But Verona are not Juve. However, there has been some news that's come out in the last 2 hours which may influence our selection choices and how we think about this game. Di Marzio, among other sources, is saying that both Vlahovic and Chiesa are not expected to play. So that is... and Danilo is out as well for Juve.
That,
so that's
their best center. Literally their best defender.
And their captain. Captain out at the back, which forces a change there. We're not as worried about that. Like, I'd potentially back us to score against them regardless, but for them to not have their go-to first choice front two of Vlahovic and Chiesa, meaning that it's probably going to be Milik and Moise Kean now. I feel a bit better about that and about the notion of playing a back four again. So I don't know.
I think I'll just stick with the back four. Just like, why change our formation when it's been working out so well, right?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I don't think that we should think about it too hard. We just need to do what we do, and the result will follow.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, I suppose, talking about this formation thing, I think the biggest consideration we've got to factor in is we've got players fit now, except for maybe Krunic, and obviously Bennacer. We've got these three games. I think Kalulu needs to feature in one of them. We need to rotate the defenders. Yeah. It could be that we do play the three at the back. I don't think it's necessarily a good idea, but we could. And then obviously PSG. I don't know, but it's something to consider. It's that congested timeline.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and quality opponents to come as well. You know, it's Juve, but then PSG and Napoli away. So there's a bit of travel involved. Teams that score goals. Like, they'll be probably... the tougher examinations. And the midfield three is something to think about as well, because we believe that Krunic is going to be back in group training from tomorrow when the team get back at Milanello. So that means that he should be fit and fully available for the game against Juve. Again, that's a pretty recent update that's come out, along with Loftus-Cheek as well. So what three are you going for in midfield? Do you give Adli that vote of confidence and hope that, because Juve tend to sit off a bit more, Adli will have the space to operate and kind of dictate the tempo? Do you go for Krunic, even if he might not be 100%, and go for the comfort blanket? Does Loftus-Cheek come back in, or do you play the hot hand with Musa, who's in very good form, obviously? Reinders obvious to keep his spot. Like, where are we going with this?
Go on, Maddie. What's your thoughts?
I spaced out on that line. But middle three, I go Musa, Reinders. Is RLC back, or Loftus-Cheek? Loftus-Cheek. I think that Krunic served a purpose at the beginning of the season, right? Mm-hmm. And like, Musa's kind of coming to his own. Like, he's showing that he can hold his own. So like, I wouldn't change it.
Mm. So I come with a completely different angle. I think that Pioli loves Krunic so much, he will want Krunic fit 100% for PSG. I think Loftus-Cheek needs to be fit and 100% for PSG, because I think he's our most important midfielder in the Champions League currently, due to his physicality and experience. And what you said at the start, Ollie, I think hopefully Pioli thinks the same. And I think it's the perfect game for Adli to play, who won't be starting the Champions League because of the sit-back nature of Juve. So I would like to see, ideally, two completely different midfields. Maybe one player could be the same between the Juve game and PSG game. So for me, it should be Adli, Reinders, Musa for Juve.
Yeah, I've got two of the three the same. I think Adli should start in this. I think Juve will probably play with the two. And I can't see them pushing up that much, and they almost certainly won't play with a playmaker, so we don't need to worry about having our number six pin anyone like that, especially if they don't have Chiesa, you know, who cuts in from more of the right into the centre, and he can cause danger that way. I think if they're a little bit more one-dimensional in attack, it's a perfect game for Adley to get on the ball a lot and to be shielded, protected, and to be able to get the ball forward into the wide areas quicker, where you hope to turn their defence around. Because if the players in front of Juve, they're fine, but if you get them turned around, then they struggle, as Sassuolo should. So I'm picking Adley at the base. I'll have Musa on the right because I don't want to rush RLC back too quickly. Mm-hmm. This feels like a game where he could do really well, you know, to use his size, his power, physicality, and really get us on top, joining the forward line to create a few more problems if they sit deep. However, I worry a little bit about the nature of his injury problems in the past. Don't want to rush him back too much. You give him half an hour off the bench. So you go with Musa in this, who's played more football over the international break, and sit with Reinders. You know, he's the big game guy. And we know from the fact that he started like 48 games or something for AZ Alkmaar last season that he's absolutely fine. Yeah. Oh, you want Musa over RLC? Yeah, right, yeah. There you go then. Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. Happy days. And then there will be change. Obviously, when we come to the call next week, we'll know a little bit more about the fitness of some players based on what we play against Juve. So that will be interesting to see how we rotate for those two tougher games that are to come in what is a very, very hectic part of the season, as always, between the two international breaks. I think last thing to do is a prediction. Are we going to keep our good form going against Juve, potentially depleted Juve side? What I will say is I think we need to get Giroud back in the goals, no matter how they come, because at the moment he's really struggling to justify his place, and you've got Okafor knocking on the door. Any thought to giving Okafor a start, or maybe Jovic again?
Oh, thoughts. I have a lot of thoughts about it. I think it's fantastic.
What, Jovic to start?
No, Okafor.
Oh, yeah.
Give Giroud off. Like, give him a walker or something, man. Like, Giroud served a purpose. Okafor, Pulisic, and Liao up top would be unreal. They're all fast. They're all creative. Like, the runs in from behind, like, it'll just be beautiful.
It's a FIFA team.
Like Lorenzo has been preaching all game or all podcast, Pioli has his players: Florenzi, Krunic, Giroud. They're like his untouchables, right? I don't know why. And you know what? Isaac probably has all of their jerseys as well. So
he actually does have Florenzi and Krunic jerseys.
Florenzi jersey.
He does have all three.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. I don't know if he has a Giroud one, but he definitely has a Krunic and Florenzi jersey.
Krunic and Florenzi is so funny.
I would start Okafor, but we all know that Pioli is going to start Giroud. So
yeah. I have less. Are we talking prediction? Maddie, what was your score?
3-0, Milan.
Yeah, I like that.
I have faith in Sportiello. Like, he like showed that he can like play right and do well. So,
yeah, I agree with that. I'm completely going to contradict myself by saying Juve, obviously the Scudetto favourites, give or take. I just think that I want to justify that again. I just think the season's very long. You don't know what's going to happen in Europe. You know, teams like Inter and Milan, we want to do well and go deep, and an injury can obviously derail that. But anyway, I think we'll steamroll them, completely steamroll them. I don't think it'll be 3-0. I think 2-0, but I think it will be a dominant 2-0. I don't see them, especially if there's no Vlahovic and there's no Chiesa. Milik's going to be, he's basically a worse Giroud in every way. I don't see them threatening at all. 2-0. I think Liao and Okafor off the bench, because I think Okafor will come off from the bench. That might score.
I'll go full house and say I think we're going to win, and I don't think we're going to concede, but I'm going for a slightly tighter 1-0 margin. I think we know what Juve's game plan is going to be, for all the reasons Lorenzo highlighted earlier. They're going to try and beat the lesser sides and pick up useful points against the top sides. So I think they're going to come, and I think they're going to sit deep and try and frustrate, as they always do. in recent times against us, at least since Allegri's gone back. That's what they've tried to do. And sometimes we struggle to break them down, to be honest. But we beat them 2-0 at home last season and 1-0 away. I see it being similar to the 1-0 away game where we're just looking for that one moment of inspiration. I expect us to be on top in the game, to have a lot of the ball, to prod and pry. That's why I think an early goal in this one would completely demolish Juve's game plan, and that's where things could really come into our favour, you know, especially with having some fresh legs off the bench and stuff. But I can see us getting a winner in the second half. And why not
Florenzi goal?
Why not a Florenzi free kick, you know? Let's get that on record, and okay. I'll move on and say... I'll say Liao, but in back of my mind, it's shouting Pulisic, he's going to get another. Like, he's going to just keep being the match winner for us. And I kind of hope it happens, because people are looking at us and saying, what a bargain of the summer, stuff like that.
One thing I want to just quickly mention, sorry. Did you watch the game, Andy, the USA game? You might have watched it, Ollie, because you were there. But I think it was Timothy Weah, because he'll be playing, won't he, for Juve? He embraced Pulisic first. So I think that's interesting, because obviously, you know, there should be a bit of a rivalry there, Juve. Mm-hmm.
The USA team is very, like, a very close-knit group.
Close-knit. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. There'll be four players. I think there'll be, obviously, Pulisic and Musa, if they play on our side, and there'll be Weah and McKennie. Yeah, so, yeah.
But like, McKennie and Weah have not been starting together. I feel like it's either one or the other.
Right. Okay.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So that's Juve. Let's hope that we resume after the break in the best possible way and get some more confidence and momentum going into another two tough games that'll follow after that. Talking points back to the Mercato rumours that have been they've been put on pause for a little while. Once the window shuts, you know, you get a few weeks apiece, and then next thing you know, you're closer to January than you are to the end of the window, so they come around again. The one that is being reported by a lot of reliable sources, too many to name, to be honest, like even Romano said something, Matteo Moretto, Milan News, everybody's saying that we're going to try for Juan Miranda of Real Betis. Some are saying that we're going to try get him early in January, and that there's a bit of budget left allocated to go out and get him. And others are saying that we're going to try and get him on a pre-contract for June. Now, the other interested club is Barcelona. Where do we stand on this, boys? Would you go for another left back as early as January, perhaps a small financial outlay for a player whose deal expires at the end of the season, and then you can maybe loan Bartezaghi out and take some of the pressure off Teo and take some of the pressure off Florenzi having to switch to the other side? Or do you wait? Do you get a player on a free ahead of a new season so they got more time to bed in? You stick with your existing options, or you use the money elsewhere in January? Like, what do you think of the Miranda rumours? I've never seen the guy play, I'll be totally honest, but he's clearly pretty highly rated, and he's clearly playing hardball over his contract because he thinks he can maybe get a better offer elsewhere. But he's 23, he's got plenty of La Liga experience. He has actually played for the senior Spain team, albeit it was 2 years ago. So I quite like the mould of player for a backup, but I'm not sure about January.
I think it depends on where we're at in January, right? And how Teo is. If Teo gets another five red cards or yellow cards. If he gets another five yellow cards, like, you're going to want to, you know, look at a good backup. Jerry wants to win now, right? He doesn't want to win next season. He wants to win this season. So, you know, if the Scudetto race is as close as it is now, like, you might see the investment. If we're, like, taken off, you might not. My dog has to go outside, so I'm going to be right back.
Yeah, those are my fair thoughts. Enough. Yeah.
So what do I think? I think a left back would be a great, any kind of reinforcement in winter is fantastic. I actually I feel almost like we're guaranteed to actually sign a player in January for once, which is a really weird feeling. I do think there's a few million left over from the summer. Mm-hmm. I just think that it's less important. I mean, we need a central defender. We do need a fullback, but we need goals more than that. So if we had a few million pounds, I don't think Taremi's the answer, but I genuinely think we need goals. Giroud, I think it's real push time for Giroud now, because we've got how many more games until the January transfer window? Eight?
Oof, good question. Yeah, maybe around that. Yeah.
Say 10, right? If Giroud scores 3 goals or less, that's a real problem, unless we're getting goals for Okafor starting and things like that. So what Maddie said is, I don't think we can answer that question until January comes properly. But to kind of make it a moot point, I do think we're definitely going to get a reinforcement. For once, I genuinely believe what Cardinale has been saying. I think he's actually going to back it up, and I think he will do something, whether it's a pre-contract agreement for Miranda, whether it's signing a centre forward, short-term goal option, whatever. It's definitely positive. And I agree. I think Miranda, from a mould, never seen him play either. Seems like a decent pickup at 23.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I think the biggest priority should be to fix what we tried until the end of the window to fix, and that would be to sign a centre forward that guarantees you more goals than what Luka Jovic can. And we haven't really seen what Jovic can do yet, because he's not 100%, admittedly. But I don't think he's going to be the answer to all those problems. But I also think that the next investment that we make in a striker has to be a big one. You know, I don't think it can be another stopgap. And then you start thinking, can you get value for a player in January? You know, is say a Jonathan David, who's been the biggest link, is he going to be available in January? And is he going to be available for less than 50 mil? Whereas if you're willing to put that pursuit off until the summer, you maybe get him for a fairer or like a lesser risk price, especially given he'll be a year away from the expiry of his contract. So I think we're going to wait before we invest big in that number 9. But we've been waiting for years now. So it needs to happen at some point, like 100%. The left-back thing, I agree, it's circumstantial. Like, we need to see where we're at. We're probably going to see a couple more times where Teo doesn't start games. And then we'll learn a bit more about whether Florenzi is reliable switching over to that side. We may even learn about if there's more trust in Bartoszaki than what we think. If there isn't, then I think that Pioli might have a word and say, just get on the phone to Betis and see if they'll accept a few million, you know, rather than losing him for free the next summer. And then maybe you think that's a good opportunity that you need to seize. You've addressed an obvious gap in the squad without making a massive financial outlay to do it. Aside from that, I don't think you're going to get good value for a centre-back who can push to be a starter or third choice either. So I think you really are looking at, especially as a club that doesn't tend to do big business in January. We've seen that even since we switched to the American ownership. I don't expect us to be going out and splashing loads of money, even if we've got that 18 million that we'd agreed for Taremi. I think that will just be pushed further along and we'll probably be put towards the bigger investment for a striker. So I think it's a case of watch this space for Miranda. Both Matteo Moretto and Romano said that we're looking at it more for June than for January. So I do think that we'll try and get him on a free. So I do think we'll try and get him on a free. And also a couple of reputable journalists have said that Taremi thing's dead. Like, things soured so much with the changing demands last minute that's probably not something that we're going to reopen, which I think
we'll go to Inter in January. I can see it.
Yeah,
now.
He might do. And win them the league. Yeah. 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 Ibrahimovic did a little bit of a speech. He did an interview on stage at the Festival dello Sport, which is held in Trento. I think it's like the sixth year that they've had it, but it was quite a good one. You can go on our website to read the full transcript of it. But he was asked about a number of different things. He was asked about the Balotelli-Lukaku beef. Sorry, not Balotelli-Lukaku. The Balotelli-Liao stupid comparisons about like attitude and stuff. Then about the beef between him and Lukaku. That was pretty good. He was also asked about potentially returning to Milan. And he said, as part of a bigger paragraph of text, he said, let's see what happens if something happens. I had a few meetings with Milan, the boss, the other boss. Let's talk. Let's see where we get. It's time to get to know each other. That to me sounds like he's pretty open to the idea of coming back. But he did also say in amongst that that he's only been retired for 3 and 4 months and he's enjoying the freedom and that he wants to wait before he makes a decision. I'm now thinking this is a matter of time rather than it's a when, not if kind of thing for when he comes back. What role remains to be seen?
Even Jerry's been talking about it at length. And I think when you've got the big boss at Milan talking about it in even some detail, even though he's not alluded to him joining, he's obviously just said it's up to him, et cetera, et cetera. There's definitely more there to it. But one thing I do want to say is, I'm sure you guys, some of you guys listening have heard the Piers Morgan interview or read even some of his books. Like AJ, I'm a massive Zlatan fan. He's one of my favourite players of all time. I think we're just waiting to create a role called the CEO of adrenaline because that's his favorite word.
Yes, he uses
adrenaline every. I think I haven't read his book for a while. Read his I Am Zlatan book. One he released when he was at PSG. It was one, I actually love that book, and must have forgotten. He uses the word adrenaline so much.
Yeah, he does.
Context pisses me off
when it just doesn't really. So when we match create the CEO of adrenaline. What's going on?
I hate to break it to you, but that book was actually fake.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, I know, it was ghostwritten, but I liked it anyway. But
he'll have had to sign it off. So in effect, those are sort of his words. And I do imagine him saying them.
That's probably why they put them in the book, because people are like, oh, you could definitely imagine him saying this, right? Like,
Yeah. And then the follow-up book was called Adrenalina.
Oh, stop that word, man. I can't.
Yeah, it's strange. Annoys
me. I love the man, but that just stops saying adrenaline.
He's doing the media. Anyway, that's a good thing. He's doing the media tours now. Like, he's doing the media rounds. He's doing his bit. So maybe he just had a few commitments that he needed to get out of the way. And then that's the beauty of us potentially creating a role for him, is that he can join at any time. You know, if it were to be a new year thing, right, you come in from January and you're around the squad and you're doing some ambassador stuff. That could be a really useful boost for us. And it's not necessarily something that's time sensitive. Like, he has to come in at the start of a season. It's interesting to see that this keeps going. And as I say, I think it's a case of when and not if. Those are the talking points. Let's move on and do some listener questions. Apologies for the brief delay here while I get up the list of questions. Oakland guy asks, will they ever go with Pulisic as the number 10 and Chukwueze at right wing? So 4-2-3-1. People want the 4-2-3-1 back.
No.
I'm joining the shaking heads. I don't see it. We spent all summer talking about the need for a formation change and how we needed more balance in the team because the back four was too exposed. The team was stretched. We were like, get in. We've gone for a midfield three. Our summer transfer business signing Reinders, Musa, Loftus-Cheek is geared around that midfield three because we've got so many box-to-box players now. And we've got two for each position really in the attack as well. I don't think we're going to start fucking about with the formation, to be totally honest with you. I know Pulisic has played 10 at Dortmund. He's done it, obviously, for the USA plenty of times. But he's been doing so well for us off the right. I see his secondary position as on the left, to be honest, more as Liao's backup. So I don't think we should deliberately tweak the formation just to get all those three players in. What I would say is Chukwueze needs to start showing that he's worth his money. And he needs a couple of starts to do that. I'm almost certain it'll get one in the three games that are coming up. You know, it might be PSG away that we set him on, whoever it will be at left back, and say good luck. But I think people had it the other way around coming into the season. They thought Pulisic might be the one that would take a bit of time, and Chukwueze is going to be the one that we are so excited to watch. But thoughts? Not changing formation?
No way. No. I mean, we create so much more in the 4-3-3. Our issue used to be, maybe not last season or the start of last season when we were still using the 4-2-3-1, was actually creating the chances. Now, and also finishing them, but more creating them. Now it's more just finishing. I'm sure you guys would agree, we create chances for fun at the team right now in a 4-3-3. One thing I do want to ask, Maddie, you're probably best placed to answer this though. Whenever I have watched Pulisic play for the national team, obviously he plays centrally and he comes off the wing into the centre. His movement in the centre is very good. I think he's more capable of playing down the middle than Leao, for example. Leao can never play in the middle. I don't think he's got the brain for it. His style of play is purely a winger, right? So it would be interesting to see. I think Pulisic is capable of playing as a 10. I just don't think...
I think his best position is playing on the wing and then moving his way in.
Yes.
I don't think it's playing as a creative midfielder. But keep in mind, like, he plays that way because the U.S., like, up until, like, the past year or two, like, he was the team.
Yeah.
Like, he had to create everything, right? So, but, like, we also see it here. He starts on the wing and then he moves his way into the middle.
Like,
you know,
and that is one defense that people have rightly used about Giroud and especially about Leao is that they occupy defenders, so there is going to be that space to move into, and that's how we've seen him score so many of his goals for us. And you know, previously at Dortmund, he's good at exploiting the spaces and bless you, whoever that was. So I'm not in favour of changing the formation, but I think Pulisic is going to take up those central areas naturally. USA expat asks, is Leao free or limited when it comes to defensive duties for the team? Now, this is something that has been attracting a lot of debate, to be honest, because there are people who believe that with the switch to a 4-3-3, Leao has found himself basically not having to track back as much, and that means he can stay up the field, he can be our outlet, he can get the ball in one-on-one situations, but it can also make him appear as though he's not doing much. Like, when we're not in possession, he just wanders around. But then there are other people who have noticed him tracking back more and getting more stuck in from a defensive point of view. And I tend to side with that. I think it differs from game to game based on the opponent that we're playing. But I actually think we're seeing a more and more well-rounded Leao who knows when he needs to do some tough defensive work and knows when he can afford to sit on the halfway line and be our outlet on the counter. I don't know what you boys think.
I would agree with that. But I do think it comes off as like being lazy, but like you also need that outlet, right? Like Giroud's not going to, you know, be cherry picking the off sideline and then try to get the ball and walk to it, right? Leao's the fastest player on the pitch. So
I think I agree with both of you guys, but I also think there's a distinction between Champions League games and league games. I think in the Champions League you have to track back more. He has in the games where he's won those awards. Even though he wasn't really deserving of a couple of them, it was because of his defensive, just overall play, which obviously defensive comes out of it. He can be lazier, if you like, in the league because of the weaker opposition. You simply cannot not track back in top European football. I mean, look at Vinicius Jr. You just can't. And I think Leao wants to be, well, because it's so physical and so demanding and every part position in the pitch it needs that level of support. And I think Leao's quite conscious of the fact that I don't think he is quite at that top level yet. Obviously, you can only do that on the European stage. So for me, I think it's more of he tracks back, generally speaking, in the more Champions League games, and he's a little bit freer in the league games, especially against a sort of weaker opposition.
Yeah, and I think that's probably how it should be as well. You know, if you're asking him to constantly bomb back for games against Torino and Hellas Verona and Bologna, I get pretty pissed off about that, especially when these are teams that defend deeper and sometimes you need that speed to be ready immediately to try and prize them open. I also think sometimes people, do you know, like in the same way that people forget that what Ibra's doing is an act, you know, they think, oh, he actually is like that. He actually does speak in metaphors when he's with his wife. Maybe he does, I don't know. But he actually is like that all the time. And it's not just a false arrogance thing that he's had his entire career to deflect from. You know, he comes from the streets of Malmo. He did not grow up that arrogant. It's all a facade. I actually think you could probably draw a comparison with Leao. And I think that his body language, when he looks like he's just sort of sloping around the field and stuff, which we've all seen it, you know, you're lying if you say you haven't. I think that might be like a false sense of security thing. As if like they think, oh, he's not doing anything, you know, he's not involved in the game, he's over there, he's moping around. But then when he gets his chance, he's fucking straight into it, right? You know what I mean? Almost as if to the fullback's thinking that's fine. I've got that distance from him, and he's not looking like he's ready to run immediately. And the next thing you know, he's completely burnt him.
So he's playing dead.
Essentially, yeah. I do think there is a bit of that, you know, and it'd be interesting to watch that. Now I've had that thought in my head, to watch it and see if it does add up. See if, like, the moment we win the ball back, bang, he's on it. He's like a cheater running for the byline, and the fullback's lost the yard separation that they had. But yeah, I do think there is a bit of that, because I think it's so obvious now with football. Body language gets scrutinized so much. And when Liao has been scrutinized for his body language, I don't think it's particularly wise if he has big periods in games where he is just ambling around the field. But I think there must be more to it. You know, it's to try and create the impression that he's not in the game, when in actual fact he is very much in the game at all times. Michael Gambino. What's that?
Sorry, I just wanted to very quickly say I saw a little bit of that in the Dortmund game, I think it was one centre-back was Schlotterbeck. I don't know who the full-back was, but where he was basically, I think it was first 20 minutes, first half, he was doing nothing, and then he was a bit mopey, and then all of a sudden, I mean, Schlotterbeck, if you don't know, is one of the fastest centre-backs around as well. He's incredibly rapid, tall, slender guy. Had him on toast, and he had to foul him to get the ball off him, and I think that's just testament to what you were just saying.
Yeah, if you need to use the art of deception with body language, then absolutely go for it, because we know what he's like when he gets in full stride. Michael Gambino asks, and we did have to come to this at some point, thoughts on the Tonali saga? He says the dream scenario is that he gets cut due to lengthy suspension and comes back on a free Fellaini masterclass.
Wow, what's he smoking?
I love it. I love a pint or whatever Michael is drinking.
Yeah.
So to preface all this before we give our speculative opinion on this, because at the time of recording, we don't have all the facts. To preface all this, gambling addiction is very real. We know that, and we know that it affects people who have very little money and a lot of money, as we're seeing with Ivan Toney, and now we're seeing with all this information that comes out. But we don't know to what extent the gambling has been done. We know that there's been some stuff with online casinos, roulette, blackjack, that kind of thing, poker. But my personal guess is that there must be some football implications within this, because otherwise it wouldn't be so serious. You know, we're still waiting for everything to come out, and it will come out. So this might already be out of date within 24 hours. We'll wait and see. As for Tonali and the notion that we got rid of him because we knew all this was coming out, that's bollocks. You know, we cannot. Yeah, that is ridiculously speculative and nonsense, because if we can do a background check, then so can Newcastle, who are paying $80 million to sign the guy. I think Pellegatti said it best. What knock-on does this have on Milan? If Tonali is found to have bet on games involving Milan versus if he has just been playing poker online, whatever, it should be nil. It should be nothing. Because he's not part of a big spot-fixing, match-fixing ring. You know, the worst thing that might have happened, we presume, is that, you know, he put a bet on a team. As far as we know, it's not us. So the implications go so far as, potentially, if he's found to have broken some regulations and he gets a ban from playing for Newcastle, you know, he gets a ban from playing Premier League or UEFA competitions, then we might miss out on some bonuses, some appearance, goal, assist bonuses. That is probably as far as it should go. That being said, it does draw once again to the surface a bigger issue within the sphere of football, which is how much exposure and how much reliance there is on the gambling industry, you know, sponsors and accessibility to it. There's both sides of the fence on this argument. You know, whether players should know better given the access to the knowledge that they have, or whether they are likely to know less because of how exposed to it they are. There's arguments on both sides. But yeah, that was just a preface. I just hope the best from all this. I hope it doesn't get any muddier than what we've seen, because it seems like Italian football can't go very long without a scandal. I'll just leave it at that. Go at it, boys.
Listen, if he just is a gambling addict and he's not gambling on sports, then it's none of our business. right? Like, but if he's like gambling on sports, then there is an issue. I don't think that there is a whole, we need to sell him before this news breaks. Like that just sounds like a conspiracy theory. Now, maybe like they're like, hey, he's gambling on, like, maybe like there was like a little Tweety bird in their ear, you know, when they're like, we need to sell Liao Teo or Tone Nally, you know, maybe like just play like a tiny factor, but I think that is very far fetched.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, there's obviously an iceberg here. There's a deeper problem of gambling and football with them being huge contributors from funding and sponsorship, which is a huge gray area, and something that obviously is clearly affecting a lot of young players, like you said, with Ivan Toney. And now the only thing that worries me a little bit is the fact that Tonali's not the only one. You've got Tonali, Fagioli and Zaniolo all involved, all Italian national team players, all around about the same age. That suggests to me that there could potentially be something under the surface that's a little bit less innocent than, I have a bit of a gambling problem, I need help. That's the only worrying part for me when you've got multiple parties involved. But generally, from a Milan perspective, it's not really our problem anymore. It's not really our issue. And I don't think in any way it will come back to bite us. But ultimately, let's hope for these young guys, because they are young people at the end of the day, that they get the help they need to obviously alleviate the problems that they have, because gambling addiction is no joke. But from a Milan perspective, I don't think we've got anything to worry about, to be perfectly honest. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, well said. Couldn't say it any better than that. Final question comes from John Bonak, who asks, do you find it difficult to get tickets when you travel to Milan for games? The process of getting tickets 15 days before matches via public sale makes international travel difficult to plan. How did you find getting tickets when you went to the Lazio game, for example, Lorenzo?
Annoyingly, I don't think I've got a panacea for the person asking the question, because it is, I think, unfortunately, by virtue of the fact, a bit up in the air. Me and Anthony managed to get one fairly early, but we already had a plan, a holiday booked, and then the game was an addition. If you're kind of booking to go to a game, I think it's just last minute. That's just the nature of it, unfortunately. How easy is it? It's like going for any kind of ticket. I don't know how many concerts this person's kind of gone to. I kind of akin it to that. You know, you've got to be on there, got to try and get one early, especially if it's a big game, and then you try and get your best seats. I don't have any particular sort of hidden websites or anything like that you can use. My only advice is, if you're booking to go to a game specifically, and that's the reason you're going to Milan, for example, then yeah, you've got to basically be on it, and then obviously try and do it as early as possible. But because of when they release the tickets, there's not much more you can do other than just doing it as early as possible.
But there's also so much more to do in the city than just go to the game, right? So, like,
absolutely. So,
speaking from plenty of experience myself, I've been there so many times.
You actually lived there. You lived there for a decade.
No, but like, you know, I know that when we booked our trip to go see Everton play Liverpool, like, we booked it around that game. I booked the flights, then bought the tickets like 6 months later. And then I tried to change our flight so we could stay longer, because I was like, what was I doing? Right. So I think that, like, you know, especially coming from the States, like, it's fucking expensive. So make sure, like, you take your time and, like, explore Milan, you know, the surrounding areas. I think Como is only like an hour away. So, like, there's so much more to do than just go see the stadium. And, like, the shitty part, if you don't get to go to the game, like, that's going to suck, but go to a bar and watch it at the bar. I'm sure, like, the atmosphere at the bars will still be electric. I don't know. You guys would know, but, you know, the worst part is you're watching Milan play in a bar in Milan, you know, like,
yeah. I do subscribe to the belief that if you really, really, really want to get to a game, like, you are desperate. So, for example, you have traveled overseas and you've spent a lot of money on flights and hotels to be there, and it's a high profile fixture, because let's be real here, it differs based on the demand for the game. If you're over there and you're trying to go see Milan Cremonese, you'll have no problem when it goes to general sale in terms of trying to get a ticket. You will be fine to get one for a few days after. The game will probably, hopefully, still sell out, but you've got a bit more time before it does. Even the Juventus home game made it to general sale, but has now sold out. Speaking from experience on this one, because normally when I've been recently to San Siro, I've covered the game for the site, so I've been fortunate enough to have the media access. But me and my girlfriend Jordan are going to watch the PSG Champions League game, and I mistakenly presumed that we would be fine to log on the day after general sale starts because of the pricing of it. It's very, very high prices. Like, the lowest price ticket is €90 in the third tier. The second tier stuff is like 130, 140. So I thought, based on how the Newcastle game sold, that was an earlier kickoff, but still, like, you look at the pricing, it took a while for it to sell over 65,000. I thought we'd be fine. We'll just log on, you know, the day after general sale starts. Logged on and it was sold out. All the tickets gone. So we essentially fucked it. And the demand was way higher than what I expected. If I'd have been on it the day that general sale began, because it did go to general sale, I'd have joined the queue and would have probably had a selection of where to sit and stuff like that. So you've got to be on it timing-wise. That's definitely one piece of advice if you're going for a high-profile game. Be wary of buying from third parties. That is definitely something. I know that in American sports, we were having a discussion about this in the chat. I know that for like American sports and even for some games over here, they have an official third party seller, be it like StubHub or something like that. Milan do not. They always recommend that you buy official. And if you buy from a third party seller, then you can get into some dodgy areas because every ticket in theory has a name on. And if that name doesn't match up when you're trying to get into the stadium, it will flag up and it can be a problem. But oftentimes, if you're buying from someone, they will pay to get the name changed for you and stuff like that. But just be wary of that and make sure that you're going through all the precautions and there's guarantees and you're sending the money in a secure way and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, I have noticed that it's harder to get a ticket since we got good again. And I kind of hope that would be the case, because if we were still playing in front of 40,000, that would suggest there's something wrong to me. And it's good that we're getting constant 70,000 plus crowds, because I think that's persuaded us to build a bit of a bigger stadium than we were going to. It's going to be a 70k new stadium, and yeah, it has been tougher since we became better. The demand is up, the prices are up, but the demand seems to match it. And Champions League games are naturally going to be tougher to get tickets for, because we've only got a guaranteed 3 home games per season in that, you know, providing that we don't get to the knockout stages. So just do as much research beforehand as you can into the dates that they go on various tiered sales, and book anything. If you're having to book stuff in advance before the tickets go on sale, book like a refundable hotel. That would be my advice, because say you wanted to cancel the whole trip because you didn't get tickets for the game. Matty's looking at me there.
Cancel the trips, not Oliver.
Yeah. You can book a refundable hotel through booking.com, and then if things don't work out the way you want, you get the money back on that at least. But I know you can't necessarily do that with the flights. So I do sympathize with those traveling, especially over the ocean, you know, to get to games.
Book Delta. They are refundable, not American Airlines. Ask AJ.
There you go. Yeah.
That was not a sponsored ad, by the way.
But Delta, if you are
listening, we're more than welcome.
Do you know, we flew American Airlines to and from Chicago, and they're the best airline that I've ever flown with. They were really good. Yeah. We flew on one of them Dreamliners, you know, the new Boeings, and well, they're maybe not that new anymore. But the legroom, I mean, I'm a big guy, but the legroom was fantastic. They had plug sockets in the seats in front here. They had really, really good recent in-flight entertainment. The food was genuinely nice. The service was
annoying, though.
Yeah, the adverts are annoying, yeah. But the staff really looked after you. They come in giving you complimentary stuff all the time. Like, you just get such bad experience.
It's a normal flight in the United States.
I don't know. I don't think it is. I've heard some bad reviews. Okay,
maybe just when you pay for it. Like, we fly Delta everywhere we go, and like, there's always plugs, there's always free stuff, you know.
There you go. How long you don't get that.
But I do want to add that ticket conversations in the Sempre Milan chat get heated.
They do.
Like, heated. Also,
do you know what? That'd be a good topic for a bonus. because we get fired up about that coming from both sides, because I'm like very English in the football's for the working man, you know, price exploitation shouldn't happen. And then, and Maddie and AJ in particular are like, well, price it.
How much would it cost you and Jordan all together to go to Milan PSG? Flight, hotel, ticket. Rough estimate.
About 200-250 quid each.
Oh yes, I say five.
To go to Monday night football, 20 miles down the road against the Raiders for like decent seats, $300 each plus fees.
Yeah,
for Monday night football.
But that's not like that. You shouldn't then say that should happen in Europe as well. We should be saying it should be better in America. Like sports should be more affordable for you guys rather than have it spread.
But unfortunately, well, I was actually going to say this when we were talking about the stadium and prices earlier. Guys listening, if you've not been to the San Siro before, or you know, you've read about all the stadium stuff happening, we have American owners, you look at the Premier League, they are going to be the cheapest they are from now until 5 years. As soon as that new stadium is built, it will be double the price. I mean, you try and go to any Premier League game, there are a couple exceptions, but Arsenal... being a lot of my friends who support and go to the Emirates, it's extortionate. It's the that will be Milan in 2028 when this new stadium is built. I can guarantee that. So
they've got a really, really fine balance to tread, because the ultras still hold a lot of power. And if they shoot too high, then they will have protests on their hands. And then it's if they push back and say, I'm sorry, but this stadium needs paying for. We've built this stadium. It needs paying off. Or they say, we don't want to turn these guys against us. I don't know. That's going to be a whole other ball game. But yeah. I struggle to see how it can get higher than 135 euros for a
when I went to
in a Champions
League. The Merseyside Derby, it was only $100 a ticket, which I was fine with paying. And we bought six tickets.
I've got another example of this.
Liverpool is cheap, to be fair.
It's the only European game I've been to, so...
Yeah. Liverpool London is very much like a proud working class city where if you try and rip the working people off, they will have a go at that. As an example of this, we're playing 1 week from Saturday. Huddersfield are playing Leeds, and it's our big derby. It's away. It's at Elland Road, and they have initially charged £47 for an adult ticket for championships or second division football. And that was obviously met with a lot of anger and ire. And they've just announced now that they've changed the price to 20 or £21. So fan power does still exist. Like, it can get shit done. Enough people complained that they dropped the price by over half, you know?
To go to a Division 2 game here, it's $20.
Yeah. But this is a big one. You know, this is what they call Category A. You know, it's a rivalry game. But £47 is where people drew the line. And they were like, you're taking the piss out of us.
So you're saying Detroit City versus London Town FC is not big?
I thought you were taking the piss out of London for a second.
No, I thought it was like London, a European, like, small club coming over to play. So I think they're in, like, Connecticut or something.
Yeah. Right, well, boys, we'll wrap it up there. This has been a fun one. Thank you to everybody who listened. And thank you, as always, to our Substack founding members, Des, Windsor McGlynn, Ali Tareen, Tito Mack, Moritz Pullman, Joey Gawler, Kemin, MJ, and Matt. We'll be back with another bonus episode for you guys later on in the week. Looking forward to getting Serie A action back on the way, hopefully with a win against Juve. Let us know your thoughts on what we've discussed this week and some questions for next week in the comments. I've been your host, Ollie Fisher. Find me on Twitter at Ollie Fisher. Maddie, cheers for joining.
Yeah, I will say whenever Oliver goes, it's going to be a quick episode. It takes an hour and a half.
I don't even know what we're on at the moment.
It's been an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah. No, thanks for listening, guys. As you all buzzing to see us play on the weekend, bored of international football. Bring it on. Yeah,
agreed. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. We will catch you in a week's time.
Goal! I got it now. È una meraviglia! Il gol di Teo Hernandez da un'area all'altra. È una meraviglia. Senti.